offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triumph Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and as always, I'm here to continue the series where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse in as much detail as we possibly can. Of course, there's always more we can do, but I think we are already thorough enough and we are going at a pretty comfortable pace of 2 or 3 shlokas per episode. I hope that is fine, and it certainly gives us a lot of opportunity to reflect, gather what Swami has spoken on this topic, gather what Swami has said in the Gita Vahini about the verses which we are discussing and elsewhere in Swami's discourses, and we will continue to do that with Swami's grace. We are pretty much towards the end of the 4th chapter, and I think we should conclude it by next week. We won't be doing it this week. We'll be concluding it in the next episode. The 4th chapter is a chapter we saw at least 3 different themes coming through in this chapter. I will not go back into the summary of whatever the 4th chapter says. Probably we'll do that next week and the week that follows. We are in the, as I said, the fag end of the chapter. And we are in a portion where Krishna is glorifying jnana after having told Arjuna how to acquire the jnana, the most important verse being how to acquire it from the tattvadarshis and jnanis. He now goes on to explain the glory of jnana itself. So as always, we'll begin with a short summary of what we covered last time, and what the verses that we're going to cover today are pretty much a continuation of that. We covered 3 verses, 35, 36 and 37 last week. And in the 35th verse is when Krishna begins to speak highly of jnana and the different qualities of jnana. He said in the 35th verse that when once this jnana is acquired, there is no looking back. Moha or delusion is completely removed and it leaves never to return again. And Krishna says to Arjuna that when you acquire this, you will see that all beings are in your own self and you will see everything in me, where Krishna speaks as Ishvara or as the Lord. And we've seen this before. There's a clear difference where Krishna is speaking as a wise person, where he makes references to the Shrutis. He says, it has been said, it has been understood, it has been discovered by the great jnanis. But at certain points, he starts speaking as Ishvara himself. And this is one of those verses where he says, when you acquire that jnana, you will see all beings in yourself and you will see that in me. So these are 2 classic descriptions of that jnana, verse number 35 speaks of, which is one that jnana comes to stay. And when jnana stays, delusion leaves never to return again. That is one of the classic definitions of this jnana. How is it different from other knowledges and other wisdom that we might acquire? And the other is the sense of non-dualism, which Krishna speaks about in the 2nd line of that verse. In the 36th verse, Krishna says, even if you're the worst sinner among all sinners, jnana is a raft that can take you across this ocean of sin. And as we discussed last time, sin and merit is attached or... sin and merit is attached to or yoked to a person through the ego or ahankara. And the jnana that we talk of sublimates this ahankara itself. And with that, all sin must also essentially leave. But we also had the discussion how this is not to say that you can do as much sin as you want and eventually turn to a guru, do pranipata, pariprashna and seva, and then acquire the jnana which is going to burn all sin. It is not in that sense. The counter of sin is always merit. So transformation is essential within the plane in which sin is performed. But the jnana that we are talking about is something which is above this plane itself. It kind of sublimates sin as much as it sublimates merit too, because it removes the sense of doership itself. In the 37th verse, Krishna explains how this happens, how merit is all removed, because jnana is like a fire that when it is kindled, it burns all karmas. And we spoke about what it means by saying that it burns all karmas. it burns all the sanchita karma, that is all the karma that has been acquired over many, many lifetimes, because all of that does not have a target now. We spoke of how every karma, every consequence of good or bad act is a target locked missile, right? It's an intelligent missile which has its target locked, and however much the target moves, this missile is going to come to it. And in the process of acquiring this jnana, the target itself is removed. So all of the sanchita karma does not have any target to hit. And there was a debate about prarabdha. Does this speak about prarabdha karma too, or it does not speak about prarabdha karma? We had that discussion. But certainly all believe that the agami karma is certainly removed. And what is this agami karma? Literally translated, it means the karma that is yet to come. Which means even as I go through life, I am reacting to situations, I am developing new desires, I am probably, someone is doing something bad to me and I'm trying to respond to that. All of this is going to add to that sanchita karma. These are all karmas which I will eventually have to face. When we say the ahankara itself is removed, as Krishna explains so beautifully in the third verse, for a jnani there is no karma at all, because there is no sense of doership. So those were the three verses that we went through, 35, 36 and 37. Today we'll go through three verses, hopefully, if time permits. And we will be again going through a couple of phrases, not exactly the entire verse, which Swami quotes very often. Very important two verses, multiple occasions Swami has spoken about that. But we'll come to that eventually. We will first listen to verse number 38 of the fourth chapter. As always, I have it very beautifully and clearly rendered by Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus. We'll listen to that. I'll give you a brief meaning and then we will discuss in detail.
Nahi jnanena sadrisham pavitramiha vidyate tatsvayam yogasam siddha kalenatmani vindati.
In this world there exists no purifier comparable to knowledge. One who becomes prepared through yoga finds it in oneself in due course of time. So that is the 38th verse. So in continuation of praising this jnana, Krishna calls it the greatest purifier. Nyahi jnanena sadrisham. Verily there is no equivalent to jnana. Sadrisham means equivalent. But in what sense there is no equivalence? Pavitram iha vidyate. In purifying, iha vidyate means in this world. Krishna says there is no purifier better than jnana in this world. This is a little different from what Krishna has been saying so far. And that we will understand clearly when we see the next line, which is pretty much in line with what Krishna has said in the third and in this fourth chapter as well. He says in the second line, Tatha, that, meaning it is a reference to jnana, because that is what was being spoken about in the previous line too. Tatha, that, swayam, by itself, yoga samsiddhaha. One of the meanings of the word siddhaha is to be ready or is to be prepared. So yoga samsiddhaha can be translated as, it means a state of preparedness that is achieved through yoga. And in this chapter, going by the theme, the yoga that Krishna is referring to is karma yoga. Kalena, with time, atmani vindati, is acquired by one. Krishna says, for one who is prepared through the process of karma yoga, this jnana comes automatically with time. And this is why the first sentence was different from the theme of this portion. Till now, Krishna has been saying that karma yoga prepares the mind for jnana. And even in this shloka, Krishna mentions that in the second line, a prepared mind automatically acquires that jnana. If you have to be more accurate, the jnana reveals itself with time when the mind is prepared. But in the first line, Krishna says that jnana is the best purifier among all purifiers, which means he speaks of jnana also as something that prepares the mind, isn't it? So Krishna speaks of jnana as the goal of karma yoga in the second line, but in the first line he speaks about jnana as a path or a tool. And this is also a very, very important point. When we speak about karma yoga, we speak about our regular duty being performed as a sadhana, right? That is the quintessential definition of karma yoga. Just like when I sing bhajans, I convert the act, the simple act of singing, into a sadhana. When I do japam, I try to do the act of concentration as a sadhana. When I do seva, I try to convert the simple acts of kindness into a sadhana. Similarly, karma yoga is trying to convert our duties, our endeavors, and all our actions that we perform into a sadhana. A few weeks back when we were going through the book Conversations with Sai, which has been so beautifully documented by Dr. John Hislop, we are going through that as a series as part of Afternoon Satsang. Swami gives a very important instruction or a tip to Dr. Hislop, and that is in line with what we are discussing here. So I will read that exchange here once again, and then I will tell you why I wanted to quote that particular exchange. Hislop asks, in the West, sadhana is generally taken to be a process of self-improvement, but that implies identification with a changing personality. Swami replies, first, there may be the urge for self-improvement. Moral nature and character may be seen to need improvement. But the next stage is inquiry. Inquiry into the reality of this and that. 7/10 of sadhana is inquiry. I, as generally used by people, refers to the body. End of quote. So Swami clearly speaks of two stages of sadhana: self-transformation and self-inquiry. And when I say two stages, they're not separated by watertight compartments. There is an overlap, right? That's why Swami says 7/10 of sadhana is self-inquiry. And as we've seen, even in the discussion of karma yoga, Krishna had emphasized on this, that there should be inquiry. Even before he spoke about what is dharma, he spoke about the true nature of the self in the second chapter, isn't it? So in any sadhana, the urge for self-transformation is the first step. Even in karma yoga, the first step is to perform perfectly the duty that is assigned to the individual, which itself requires self-transformation. It requires that one has to become a better person than what one is. But slowly we must progress to the stage where 70% of sadhana we do must be self-inquiry, which is what is referred to by Swami in the first line, where jnana itself now becomes an agent of cleansing, an agent of preparing the mind. Which means we must begin using the path of inquiry of jnana as part of sadhana. Swami clearly says, when we first start, we try to transform this I that we associate with the body-mind complex. And slowly we must start asking, who really is this I? And when that understanding starts coming, that is a far better purifier than all other sadhana. Nahi jnanena sadrisham pavitramiha vidyate. Now, how is it better than the other forms of purification? In physics, we always speak of a phenomenon called the observer effect. In different fields of science, it is explained differently. But in essence, it means as long as there is an observer, the observation will always be skewed. In experiments, we try to study with least interference as possible, but still there will always be an observer effect which will interfere with the observation. One of the classic and the simple examples that's often given is that of finding the temperature of a trough of water. The moment you dip a thermometer into the water, depending on the temperature of the surface of the thermometer, it either absorbs some heat or it gives out some heat. So what is being measured cannot be called accurate. If I have to put that differently, the experiment was to measure the temperature of water in a trough, but I ended up measuring the temperature of water in a trough with the thermometer dipped into it. So essentially, I'm changing the system itself. The difference could be negligible, and so we don't bother much about it, about such observer effects. But when the system is far more sensitive, like when measurements have to be made in, say, the atomic levels or even in the level of the cell, the very act of observation distorts the observation. So when it comes to science, we try to minimize this observer effect as much as possible, but we have to acknowledge that as long as there is an observer, there will be an imperfection. Now, if I were to very crudely extrapolate this concept to what we are discussing, for Karma Yoga to be performed, we need a doer. We need a karta. Because everything is defined by that entity whom we refer to as the karta. Here, Arjuna is the karta. The fact that he is a kshatriya defines the karma that he is supposed to perform. The situation he is in, he's in a battlefield, trying to defend righteousness, trying to give the country a good ruler. Now that defines this karta's karma. So the doer is central to what is Karma Yoga. But Karma Yoga, as we have come to understand, becomes perfect or tends towards perfection as the karta's presence is made negligible. So Karma Yoga becomes perfect, or the goal of it is used when Karma Yoga becomes perfect when this doership or kartritva completely vanishes. And that is how the goal of this Karma Yoga itself is reached. And that begins to happen with self-inquiry. And it is in that sense, I think Krishna says, Nahi jnanena sadrisham pavitramiha vidyate. There is no equivalent to jnana when it comes to purification in this world. So in the first line of the shloka, Krishna speaks of jnana as a means. And in the second line, where he says, Tata swayam yoga samsiddha kalena atmani vindati, the one who is prepared by Karma Yoga finds it revealing itself automatically with time. In that line, he is speaking of jnana as the goal and Karma Yoga as something that prepares the mind. So that is the 38th verse. It's a very beautiful point and very important point. And I think that is, even when we were talking about the conversation with Dr. Hislop, I had made a mention of this. When Swami was speaking to another devotee whose name was Ranima, and we have an extended series about her on the website, Swami had made this very same point. Swami said, after a certain point in sadhana, your sadhana should be more of self-inquiry, and you should continue with the sadhana such as namasmarana, bhajans and seva and all of that, because we have seen that that is, in their own way, they prepare the mind, they purify the mind, they lead to antakarna shuddhi. But along with that sadhana, self-inquiry of who is this individual, who is this entity, and what is real, what is unreal, that inquiry must begin. And I think this shloka stands for that explanation that Swami gives. It's very, very important. We will now go to the verse number 39. As I said, the verse number 39 has a very important phrase that Swami often quotes. We listen to the verse in Brother Shyam's voice. I'll give you a brief meaning and then we will discuss in detail.
Shraddhavan labhate jnanam tatparasam yatendriyah jnanam labdhva param shantim achirenadhi gachati.
The man who has faith, who is diligent and has control over the organs, attains knowledge. achieving knowledge, one soon attains supreme peace. As I said, this shloka contains a phrase that Swami would so often quote, Shraddhavan labhate jnanam. And in the next verse, there's another phrase. Swami says this phrase and that one, they are like the two mantras that form the two banks for the river of life itself. But of course, we'll talk about that later. I'll maybe read out that statement from Swami's discourse itself, if not today, the next week. But let us come back to the shloka and what is the very interesting and very important point that Krishna is making here. Now, Krishna starts speaking about the prerequisites for that jnana. Initially, he spoke about how to attain that jnana, and go to a guru and attain it from that person in this process. And then he started speaking about the glory of the jnana. And now he starts speaking about the few qualities which are essential to attain that jnana. Of course, these qualities and these prerequisites have been mentioned in many times before. But each time it is being reiterated, there's a very beautiful and subtle point that can be understood from each one of them. And that's what we'll try to do. Shraddhavan, the one who has faith. Tatparaha, is committed and devoted. Samyatendriyaha, who also has control over the senses. Labhate jnanam, attains wisdom. Krishna makes three points here. One must have faith, one must have commitment, and control of the senses. These are three very closely connected points. Let us first talk about Shraddha. Truly speaking, Shraddha contains the other two points that Krishna is mentioning here. And that is why the state Shraddhavan Labhate Jnanam itself is self-contained and says it is one of the banks, and that is why Swami says it is one of the banks that regulate the river of life. Shraddha means faith. Faith in what or faith in who? Till now we were talking about the jnana. Krishna said jnana can be received from jnanis. So this Shraddha is a very comprehensive word. It means faith in the truth, that there is only one, that this is I as an individual is an illusion, that there is a state of superior nature, that when attained, there will be no more delusion. Whatever Krishna has been describing about the jnana, that is the truth. So, Shraddha can be spoken of as faith in that truth. And since this jnana or knowledge has come to us through these great jnanis and the scriptures that have recorded their words, Shraddha is also faith in their words. Faith in the words of the Guru. So Shraddha, I think, can be spoken of as faith in the words of the Guru, faith in the scriptures, faith in the truth, and also faith in one's own self. That is why speaking about Shraddha, Swami very extensively says, so it's a very beautiful comprehensive word, and I'll read out one small quote from Gita Vaini, and we'll discuss Shraddha again. Swami says, I quote, to acquire this sacred spiritual wisdom, one thing is essential, faith or Shraddha, steady faith in the scriptures, in the teachers, and in the acquisition of wisdom. Without earnestness born of faith, no task, however tiny, can be accomplished. Therefore, you can see how essential it is for earning wisdom. Faith is the incomparable treasure chest of tranquility or sama, control of the outer senses or dhamma, control of the mind by withdrawal of the senses uparati, fortitude or titiksha, and mind control by equanimity samadhana, each one a coveted possession. End of quote. So as I said, Swami describes this Shraddha as being a very comprehensive faith. It is faith in the truth. It is faith in the person who has described this truth to us, which is either a guru or the scriptures. And it is faith in our ability to attain that truth. And that is why the Shraddha is a loaded word and very comprehensive. Swami also says, Shraddha is the treasure chest. These qualities that Swami just mentioned, Shama, Dama, Uparati, Titiksha, Samadhana, these five qualities, along with Shraddha, are referred to as the Shat Sampattis, or the sixfold treasure, or the six virtues that are necessary for attaining the Brahman. In fact, these are qualities that turn the sadhaka towards Brahman itself. That's what Swami says in the Sutra Vahini, that these are the prerequisites for a person to start on the path of inquiry itself. And Swami says in that quote that we just heard, Shraddha itself is the treasure chest that contains all these jewels. And when we say faith, it is slightly different from what we understand from this word normally. In the previous verse, Krishna said, a person who has practiced karma yoga, for him or her, the jnana starts surfacing by itself with time, which means we don't speak of faith as merely trusting another person's word or experience. We must also see faith as recognizing what is typically referred to as, in modern parlance, the gut feeling. When we listen to the Guru, when you read the Upanishads or the scriptures, somewhere deep within, you know that this is the truth. You have that quote-unquote gut feeling. You relate to what is being said in a level that is beyond the mind. Many people, when they first come to Swami, they say that the moment we saw Swami, we felt that He is the one. He is the divine incarnation. Some other people say that, you know, I had such and such an experience, so I believe that Swami is God. If you were to think deeply, that is not how it works. Swami would always say, first there is faith, which means the purest core in each one of us first recognizes Swami as being divine. But the mind, whose nature is to ask questions, is to raise doubts, that starts pulling us back. He looks like me, Swami doesn't seem to know my name, in what way he is different from other humans. And when we start asking these questions, and when we have an experience of Swami's omnipotence or omniscience or omnipresence, the doubts in the mind are silenced. So in spirituality, faith is not believing in another alone. It is not in that sense as we describe it in the language. It is not blind belief. The words of the scriptures and the words of the Guru are literally a confirmation of what is already known deep within. So having that Shraddha is itself a sign of purity. You could put it that way. Without mental purity, there cannot be Shraddha. You might say, but there are so many people whom I know, they claim to be devotees of Swami, but they don't seem to be all that pure. They don't seem to be, even comparable in purity to those who don't claim to be Swami's devotees. Well, all that we can say is then it is not faith at all. It is not Shraddha. It is only probably a convenient tag that people choose to carry. Faith to be really faith. Shraddha to be Shraddha. The other two qualities that Krishna mentions in the shloka become very important. And when I explain that, I wonder if you and I will also make the cut. Krishna says, Shraddhavan labhate jnanam tatparaha. The next word or the quality is, Krishna says, the person should be a tatparaha. That is, it's a very interesting word. It means to be devoted or committed to that or to something, right? I believe it is formed by two words, tat and para. Tat means that, of course. So tatpara literally means to be devoted to that particular idea or committed to a particular belief. So in this context, when you see Shraddhavan tatparaha, it means to have faith in something and to be committed to that. This is the most important point in the shloka. It means to have shraddha on something, to have faith on something, and to be committed to that. It is not merely saying, I believe, or I have the faith. It is to have the faith and to be committed to that. Shraddhavan tatparaha. You have faith in the Guru's words or the scriptures, and that is not enough. You also have to have a commitment towards that. What does that really mean? Let me give an example. I'm walking down the road, and let's say you come from the opposite direction, and you tell me, don't go this way, there is a pit there, you might fall there, so don't go that way, I've just gone there and I've come back. Now, after hearing that from you, if I continue to go that same way, it means I don't trust your words. If I really have faith in your words, I will act upon it, isn't it? I will change my course based on what you have said. If I tell you, brother, I have full faith in what you're saying, but I will go this way only. How can that be faith at all? That is why Krishna says, Shraddhavan tatparaha. It is not being a person of faith alone, not having faith as a label, I am a Sai devotee. You must be a person of faith who acts upon it, who is committed to what one has faith in. The most important point. That is why, even in our relationship with Swami, we must constantly ask, how is my faith defining my life? If me being a Christian doesn't make me live life like the way Jesus taught, I am Christian only by label. And I am flaunting it for some other purpose or some other ulterior motive. If I call myself a Sai devotee and do not follow what Swami says, or at least do not try, I should at least try, right? So if I don't follow, or I am not even making the effort, then I am only wearing the label of a Sai devotee for some other ulterior benefit that this label can give me. I must be a Shraddhavan Tatparaha, a person of faith who is committed to the faith or what one has faith in. That is why Swami says, Shraddha is itself a treasure chest for all the virtues. When I have faith in the idea that I am not this body and I am not this mind, that gold is only as much worth as sand and both are equally unreal, then won't it start showing up as detachment? Won't it start showing up as equanimity in my life? As Krishna said in the second chapter, when you believe that you are the Atman which cannot be cut, which cannot be burnt or even be modified, will it not translate as fearlessness and detachment? So in a very beautiful way, the shloka describes that sequence when it says, Shraddhavan tatparaha samyatendriyaha. When you have shraddha or faith in the truth being taught by the Guru, you will commit your life to it. And that will be possible only when you are a samyatendriyaha, one who has subdued the senses. Then labhate jnanam, jnana will be attained. So the next time when we claim to be Swami's devotees or say, I believe in the message of Vedanta, we can do a self-analysis and see that we only have as much faith as we have changed our lives. And Swami would always give this example. You know that fire burns, right? And when you know fire burns, you will not even by, if somebody forces you towards fire, you will never go towards fire because you have the faith that fire burns. Not all of us necessarily would have had a fire burn. But when we have that faith that fire burns, we will keep as far away from it as possible, right? And in the similar manner, when we have faith in Swami's words, it must contort the way we live our lives. Contort not in the wrong sense. It must realign our lives to Swami's words. If Swami says, this is the best way to lead your life, and if we do not commit ourselves to that, it means nothing when we say, I have Shraddha, I am a devotee of Swami. We would often quote this example of this very great Advaitin by name Nisargadatta Maharaj. I'm sure most of you must be familiar with him and his works. He was an unlettered man. He was an illiterate man. By profession, he was a person who used to have a paan bidi shop, which is probably one of the most unsophisticated professions that you could have in India. But in spite of all of this, he was a true jnani. He was a man of wisdom. When the most educated people who would come to him would be stunned by the clarity of his explanations and how focused he was in the most purest Vedantic wisdom. Stunned by this clarity and this wisdom, when someone would ask him, you know, how did you get this realization? How did you get this wisdom? He would have a very simple answer. He would say, my guru told me, and that I am not this body and mind, that I am the Atma that is eternal, and I believed him. As simple as that. He would say that my guru told me that I am not this body, I am the Atman, and he said, I believed it, and I got realization. And he would beautifully explain how it, you know, it is not just believing like a drop of a hat. He would beautifully explain that by saying, I thought to myself, why would my guru tell me this? Why would he lie to me? Won't he tell me this only because it is true? And what will he gain if I believe in this or if I don't? So he said, I thought he must be telling the truth. And so I started believing him, and so I got realized. I think there's a very beautiful hint in the answer that he gives. Why would we believe in the scriptures? Because they are the result, or they are the works of people, of those who have attained, who have gone through the process of self-discovery, and those individuals are those who have given up everything. Their qualification is their vairagya. When I'm sick, when I'm unwell, I go to a doctor, and the doctor tells me, you need a surgery, or you take this medicine. How do I trust that person? How do I take that person's words as and act upon it? Because he has a qualification that I value. And what is that qualification? He has the degree, he has probably peer acceptance. And if we still don't trust, we can always go for a second opinion. And eventually we will know that, okay, this doctor's word can be trusted. So we always look for a qualification behind the words that we receive as advice. The scriptures have been given to us by gurus whose qualification is their vairagya, whose qualification is their absolute self-control. And Krishna says, which Shraddha you will get complete self-control, then that is also a quality that can be looked for as a qualification in the gurus, in the person whose words we want to have faith in this case, either a guru or the scriptures. There's another quality which defines such masters. And about that, Krishna makes a mention in the very next line in this very shloka. Krishna says, Jnanam labdhva. Jnanam labdhva. Having obtained that jnana, param shantim, supreme shanti, achirena adhigachati, is obtained instantly. After this jnana is attained, you don't have to wait for a few years or a few births. You attain supreme peace, and it almost like comes along with it. It's a combo pack, right? It comes along with this jnana. You don't have to wait to attain that supreme jnana. That is why achirena adhigacchati, shortly thereafter, instantly it happens. Clearly Krishna says, param shantim. It is not ordinary shanti. It is param shanti. And what is the difference? Shanti can be felt even in this mind. We call it peace of mind, isn't it? And it is almost like life breath. It is almost like the oxygen that we need to live. We all need that shanti or that peace of mind to live. At least in small doses, we want to have that. And we keep doing small activities, small endeavors we take up, trying to ensure that we have that peace of mind. In the Purusharthas, the four Purusharthas, what we refer to as Artha is typically what we gather around, hoping it will give us peace of mind. We want wealth not for the wealth's sake. We don't want dollars or rupees because we like dollars and rupees. We like the peace of mind that comes with that wealth. We want wealth so that tomorrow no need will make me feel needy, isn't it? We gather people around so we may not feel lonely. We might not sense the lack of people around. So this is hoping that we do all of this. We gather this artha with the hope that this will give us some peace of mind, or it will ensure that peace of mind. But in the world, there is no guarantee, or there is no way to say that if you have this much money, you can be peaceful for sure. If you have three daughters and four sons, you can be sure that you'll have peace of mind. There is no one who can give us a guarantee that if you lead your life in this way, you can have peace of mind. It's a blind pursuit. We'll look at people around and we pursue artha, hoping that it'll give us peace of mind. So all through life, our peace is gathered in this manner, but it is also challenged through these very processes. So this is one of the pieces, or one peace, or one shanti, which can be referred to as aparam shanti, or mundane peace, which the mind experiences. Krishna is speaking about param shantim, transcendental peace, which is beyond the mind. When we say it is beyond the mind, it is the nature of the Atman itself. Swami would often say this, shanti is my swabhava, peace is my very nature. The Atman's nature is this param shantim. So when the jnana is attained, this shanti is instantly attained along with it. And this shanti, or this peace, cannot be challenged by the changes that happen in the worldly plane. So Krishna gives the qualification required for jnana, and thereby gives us one of the banks of the river that Swami says this flow of life has to be regulated by. He mentions what the next bank is in the next shloka. We'll listen to it. We'll discuss as much as we can, and the remaining we'll probably take it over to the next week. So this is verse number 40 of the fourth chapter.
Agnyaschashraddhanascha samshayatma vinashyati nayam lokosti na paro na sukham samshayatmanah.
But he who is ignorant and has no faith perishes with his self full of doubts. Neither this world nor the other, nor happiness, is for a person who is by nature is full of doubts. So that is the 40th verse. As we've seen a few times earlier in the Gita as well, always an assertion is followed by a negation. You should have this, you should not have this. You should do this, you should not do this. If you do this, you will be saved. If you do this, you will perish. So it is not only important to speak about what one must have or one must do, but always Vedanta speaks about the firm negation of what should not be done too. That other should be removed as an option, as one of the gurus would explain. It's a multiple choice where it is not enough if you just tick the correct answer. You have to tick the correct answer and you have to strike out the wrong answers. You have to remove it from your consciousness completely as possible. So in the same way Krishna speaks of here, in the previous verse Krishna said one must have Shraddha or faith. In this verse he says one must not have Samshaya or doubt. And the other bank which we were talking about, Swami would say, Shraddhavan labhate jnanam, is one bank. Samshayatma vinashyate, the one whose self is full of doubts perishes, Swami would say, is the other bank. But like the previous verse, Krishna mentions more than one quality here. He does not speak only about doubt. He says, Agnyaha cha ashraddhanaha, the one who is ignorant and faithless. Ashraddhana is the opposite of Shraddhana, or the one who has faith. So Agnyaha cha ashraddhanaha, the one who is ignorant and faithless. Cha samshayatma, and also a doubter, vinashyati, such a person perishes. Why is Krishna mentioning all of this? Had he said Agnyaha Vinashyate, it means all those who do not have jnana, all those who are ignorant will perish, which means you, me and all of us. Because we all are ignorant. And if you had jnana, you would not be listening to this Gita series. And I wouldn't probably be reading the Gita too. We all are ajnanis, we all are agnyaha. So he does not say agnyaha vinashyati. We acknowledge that we are ignorant. And that is why we do sadhana. We are taking this effort or making this effort to acquire that jnana. But we will do sadhana or try to pursue jnana only if we are agnya and we have the faith, isn't it? Say you are hungry. What do you do when you're hungry? You eat food. If you did not have the faith that eating would assuage the hunger, you will not eat. And without faith, you probably wouldn't eat and you will remain hungry, and you will remain hungry probably till you die. Similarly, being ignorant is not the problem here. Being ignorant is not spoken of as the danger. Being ignorant and not having faith means you are ignorant and you will remain ignorant. But what makes things even worse is when one is samshayatma, a doubting self. Though the word atma is used here, it is not used in the sense of the higher self, because there cannot be any doubt in the atma. Doubt is always in the mind. So samshayatma means an individual filled with doubts. That's what it means. So why is this samshayatma coming? And the next line, Krishna says, na ayam lokaha, not in this world, na asti paraha, not in the next world, sukham samshayatmanaha, there is happiness for the doubting self. Krishna says, when you have doubts, you cannot have sukham or happiness in this world or the next world. So he does not speak of getting rid of doubts only for the sake of jnana. He speaks of that as a prerequisite even for happy living in this world. Why is he saying that? Now let us say you're agnya, you're ignorant, and you don't have shraddha in the scriptures, or you don't have shraddha in the words of a guru who says that all this world is unreal. If you don't have shraddha in that belief system that this world is unreal, you will have shraddha in the fact that the world is real. What does that mean? You believe that you can find happiness in this world. And as you have many times said, we are actually not in search of happiness alone. We are in search of nitya sukham, or happiness which is eternal, which does not come and go, but which comes and stays. So when I say that I have shraddha in the words of the masters, in the words of the guru or the scriptures, it means I believe that there is no nitya sukham in this world. I need to go beyond this world. I need to go beyond this worldly plane in search of that nitya sukham. If I don't have faith in that word, it means I have faith that nitya sukham is possible in this world itself. And when I have that faith, what do? I will pursue that in this world itself. And the world does reward, right? It might not give you nitya sukham, but it will give you some sukham, right? It will give you some happiness. There will be a happiness which comes with when you get a child, or when you get a promotion, or small successes in life, when you're trying to achieve something in business or in your career, when you find it. There will be sukha like this. So there will be some kind of sukham. In this world, there will be some sukham. But Krishna says, if you're an agnya, if you don't have faith, which means now you're not going to try to go beyond this world, you're going to remain an agnya, and you also have doubts, which makes your situation even in this life or in this worldly plane, it compromises it completely. Because you are not having faith in anyone. You're not having, when we say doubt, samshayatma means one, just like how when we said shraddhavan, it meant faith in the truth, faith in the person who is speaking the truth and faith in your own ability to find the truth. Similarly, when we talk about samshaya, when you have doubt, you doubt others, you doubt yourself, and you doubt whether that happiness can be attained at all. So Krishna speaks of samshaya as a quality of not having trust in anything, not having trust in anyone. There is somebody who has got nothing to gain from me, just like how I described the guru. The guru's qualification is the guru's vairagya, the guru's self-control, the guru's absolute selflessness. If I do not have faith in the words of somebody who is giving me the most good-willed advice, who has got nothing to gain from me, then how can I have faith on anyone? So that is why we are talking about ashraddha and samshaya as two sides of a coin. If you cannot, let's say you have a very, very noble friend, or you have a very noble spouse, a husband or a wife. If you start doubting that person in spite of knowing all the nobility of that person, it only means that you are a chronic doubter, samshayatma. That's why the word is used. It is not merely somebody who gets doubts once in a while, but you're a samshayatma. By nature, you're a person who only doubts. Such a person, there can be no happiness in this world, and there's no question of any happiness in the next world. So these are the two banks of a river, as Swami would say. One should have faith, and one should ensure that there are no doubts in the mind. Now, these are the two things which Krishna says in these two verses, but now let us backtrack a little bit and speak about the verse where Krishna said, how do you, the verse number 34, how do you approach a guru? How do you approach the jnanis and the tattvadarshis and draw from them the lesson of jnana? There Krishna said, pariprashnena, you must ask questions. But here Krishna says that you should not have doubts. Oftentimes in a classroom, when a teacher has finished a subject or finished teaching in a class, she would turn to the class and say, do you have any doubts? So is it wrong to have doubts? Here Krishna is saying if you have doubts, it is wrong. What Krishna is referring to as samshaya or doubts here is different. When you approach the master, you must have faith, right? That's what we've been speaking about. One should have shraddha. So the master, when I turn to Swami's words, whatever Swami says, I should have the complete faith that what is being spoken is the truth. But there is always a possibility that I do not understand everything that Swami says. So in such a situation, it is completely all right to ask questions. The reason I'm asking the questions is not so that I can find faults in what Swami says. I'm asking these questions so that I can come to terms with the truth that Swami is saying. So it is not, and that is why pariprashnena, and we'll discuss about that, what is the difference between prashna and pariprashna. The questioning should never come out of doubt. The service to the guru should never be out of doubt. Is my service reaching Swami? Will Swami reward me for this? That doubt should not be there. When you serve the master, when you ask questions from the master, or when you surrender to the master, that should be out of shraddha. Even the questioning should never be out of doubt. Even when you're doing seva, there should never be the idea that, oh, if I don't do seva, what will happen to me? Or is my service reaching Swami? Swami would say there should never be that doubt. And these are qualities that, as we can clearly see, one has to work upon. And that is why Swami would say that these are the two banks of the river of life. Shraddhavan labhate jnanam. The one who has this shraddha, and as we beautifully saw, shraddhavan tatparaha. We must constantly ask ourselves, how do I define my life so that it reflects this idea that I have faith in Swami's words? And I think that probably is one task if we take up as our sadhana, and can be sure that this river of life will head towards its destination. And in the process, samshayatma vinashyati. There will be doubts, right? Because that is the nature of the mind. The nature of the mind is to, as we have said, it is, you know, it always goes outward. There is a buddhi in the mind. The buddhi is always trying to see what is real, what is unreal. And all of these processes will probably throw up some doubts once in a while. But these doubts can be dealt with and must be dealt with, as Swami would say. You should not let them grow and you should not let them become a feature of your approach. That is what it means by samshayatma. Because once you start doubting any one of this, either you doubt the truth, either you doubt the Guru or Swami, or do you doubt yourself. Each of this is equally bad and it will automatically lead to the other. So these are the verses that I wanted to cover today, 38, 39 and 40. As I said, we will be concluding chapter number 4 next week. There are two more verses. And as we've been following so far, we'll probably have a summary of that in the week that follows, or let's see how it goes. So I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me week after week. If you have any questions, if you have any suggestions, if you have anything that I've said that is wrong that you would like to point out to me, feel free to write to me. You can write to our feedback email, listener@radiosai.org. Or if you so feel comfortable, you can always write to me directly at prem@radiosai.org. I'll meet you all again next week for the resumption of the Gita series, Triune Pilgrimage. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Till I meet you all next week, take care. Jai Sai Ram.